Good afternoon. The Senate Environmental Natural Resource Committee called to order Thursday, February 16, 2012. Members, two things on the agenda today. We're going to flip it around, do a flip-flop here. We're going to start out with Senator Carlson, and we're going to finish the meeting with the presentation, which is going to be could possibly take some time here, an overview from the DNR on permanent school trust lands. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I always get confused. Do we have to move this first to talk about it?
It's certainly up to you if you'd like to do that, but we certainly can. You were talking about the possibility of an amendment or something?
I think after a consultation with Mr. Knopf, we decided that we didn't need it at this time.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate File 1651.
Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same side.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, Senate File 1651 has to do with something, unfortunately, I overlooked last year. Last year we did.
Okay, we're done. Oh, go ahead.
I really wanted to talk about this. My mom might be watching this.
Bye, Mom.
It's a good bill, right?
Chair is a
this is a good bill, members.
Black side.
It's been a long week.
I guess I just wanted to apologize to the chair and members that last year when we talked about the DNR number on the bear bait buckets that we forgot to include the bear stand in the WMAs. And so this bill just corrects that and allows the bear hunter to do the Minnesota DNR number in lieu of a name and address on the stand. So we already moved it, though? No, so,
Senator,
Mom, goodbye, Mom. Well, good night, Mom.
Carlson, Senator Carlson, you may want some testimony from the DNR if they'd like to come up.
Is there any questions from the members?
Mr. Chairman, members, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I think Senator Carlson described his bill accurately. This is just an offset that previously in statute and rule we required a person's name and their driver's license number on there. This would allow them to also use their DNR number, which is a unique identification number that we can have, so they don't have to have their name or address published on a stand. We can also do this for other stands, ice shelters, and the bait stations. Now you can, as Senator Carlson was talking about, you can put your DNR number on there rather than having your specific name or address attached to a bait station in case of to avoid cases of hopefully not but hunter harassment and things like that.
Mr. Meyer, can you go through the workings of it? And a CO comes up, sees a bear, nobody around, sees a bear bait station. What does it take to get the information from that? Is it just a simple call in on radio or telephone with that number?
Mr. Chairman, so it's the way I understand your question.
It.
So they would know who owns.
That's correct.
Or who is attributed to that. Typically, they would either, depending on the location, if they had some kind of internet connection, which a lot of places in Bear Country do not have that, but they would either record that number, go back to their car or their field station or an office, and I'd be able to identify who that is by through our database. Also, then, you know, if there was a violation there, go through and contact that person and deal with that issue at that time.
Okay. Members, any questions?
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, I guess we would move this to be maybe laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus game and fish bill. That would probably be more efficient than standalone.
It's already been passed, but we can certainly possibly include it in the omnibus bill as well. So,
could we pass it one more time, sir? Thank you, members.
No, that's fine. Thank you for your brevity. Senator Scoia, your bill will take a lot longer, by the way.
Oh, gee, I thought the day was the day.
We get a little this way towards the end of the week, don't we all? Next, the presentation, Larry Krampka, Director of Public Lands and Minerals, as well as the Commissioner Landwehr. And do you have anybody else that will be coming up with you?
Dan, are you coming up?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think it's just going to be Larry and myself up here for the time being.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Well, thank you very much for having us here and giving us the opportunity to present to you today on this very complex issue that you've heard a lot about lately. There's been increasing interest in the legislature to do something with school trust lands, and you've heard a lot about what's happened in Utah and other places, and we're delighted to have the opportunity to give you the state's side of this issue as well. Now, I've been on, as you know, on the job for 1 year, and I've gotten some deep exposure to this issue. I think it's fair to say in my mind that in the past the DNR has done a good job of managing state trust lands and putting revenue into the trust fund. And I think this whole issue, the spotlight on this whole issue, is giving us even more ideas about how we can do a better job in the future, and we're always interested in continuous improvement. One of the things I want to hasten to add is you've heard a lot about what's happened in Utah, and Utah is not Minnesota. This is an apples and oranges kind of comparison. By their own admission, Utah mismanaged their funds and their school trust lands for 150 years, then saw the light 16 years ago and started doing the right thing, and also found oil and gas. And by virtue of doing the right thing with respect to managing the lands and the integrity of managing those lands, and now by virtue of the value of oil and gas, they've been able to increase their funds substantially. So they have a completely different situation in Utah than we have in Minnesota. Our trust lands, as Director Kramko will point out in a moment, are comprised largely of swamp, low-grade forest, and medium to high-grade forest. And most of the revenue that's been coming to the trust from these lands is, frankly, from mining, a very small amount from forestry. But forestry is an important part of these lands. Utah has no forest land to speak of. Most of their revenue has been derived either from land sales or from oil and gas leases. So, it's a very different story that they've got in Utah versus here. But again, I think the value for me in these discussions has been to hear how Utah is doing things, how they're thinking about things, and looking at ways that we might do things differently here as well. And that has been of high value. We have been doing some things over the last year that have been a long time in coming. We're in the final process of developing a commissioner's operational order. For those that aren't familiar with that term, it's an internal guidance to the department on how, in this case, how we will manage those lands, what we will do when there's a conflict of interest around those lands, how we account for expenditures, and so on. It is a document that transcends commissioners, so it will be in place even when the next commissioner comes, and so it's more than just the life of this administration. It will be a good guidance document that will, I think, improve the transparency and the accountability for everybody to see about what's going on here. But we're doing more as well, and you've doubtless heard a little bit about the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Exchange. There's 86,000 acres of school trust land in the Boundary Waters that we are actively working to either swap out and get new trust lands outside the Boundary Waters or cash out for the lands that are in the Boundary Waters. Because those lands are in the wilderness area, there's no commercial revenue coming off of those. That's a problem that's been there for 40 years, and we're trying to fix that. So we're actively working on that. We're doing some other, taking some other steps with respect to selling lands, especially lands that have some development opportunity. We did put a tract up near Eveleth a couple months ago, the St. Mary's Lake tract that had some development potential. Unfortunately, this time of in the economy is not a good one for real estate. We didn't get any takers on that, but it's an example of some of the types of things we're doing to look at how to generate revenue to the trust. When you start looking at bills, I want to tell you my perspective. I don't think that separating the state's 5.5 million acres into two separate agencies makes much sense. When you look at these lands, they are closely intermingled. I don't think having green trucks going by blue trucks to do the exact same management activities on adjacent lands makes much sense. I don't believe making government larger at this point in time makes much sense. And I think there's some very serious issues that people have not even begun to ponder about how this sort of a separation of land management would actually be undertaken. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, with that, I'd like to turn it over to Larry Kramka to give you a little more information just on the background of trust lands in Minnesota, what the department is doing, and how we propose to go forward.
Commissioner, a couple questions, if I may. Your opening statement was that Utah was different than us, no question about that. But you also made the statement that Utah 16 years ago changed to the plan that we're somewhat familiar with. And at that time, they found oil and coal. Did they not know of that before that changed?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, several things actually happened in Utah. And for the first 150 years of the trust, they had somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 million acres of trust land to start with. They're down to 3.5 million now. First 150 years of statehood, they generated $18 million into the trust. By comparison, our first 150 years, we generated somewhere in the order of $600 to $700 million. They were fraught with corruption and handshake deals and backdoor deals and all kinds of things that resulted in most of the money not going into the trust. In 1996, they realized that something had to change, that they were the bottom state in all the states, and they had to change their system, so they completely revised how their trust lands are managed. They did set up a completely separate administration for managing those trust lands, but most importantly, they also happen to have stars line up on their behalf. And what I mean by that is that they had land distribution similar to ours, but 67% of Utah is owned by the federal government, Bureau of Land Management in particular. And they made an appeal to then-President Clinton, who mandated to Secretary Babbitt that they shall undertake subsequently two land exchanges. And in the process of doing these land exchanges, the state of Utah had the ability to essentially put the blinders on Bureau of Land Management and say, okay, these are the lands we want. So they got to go to the federal portfolio and say, okay, we want these lands. And they deliberately chose lands that were close to urban areas, and they deliberately chose lands that they knew had stores of oil and gas. So when they did these two swaps, what they were left with was a very high-graded portfolio of lands. There was some knowledge that there was oil and gas on there, but the lands had not yet been capitalized on. So as soon as they had those two exchanges, they were able to start capitalizing on those oil and gas reserves.
Okay. I guess the point is that it took something to get that action going, I'm not saying that this is similar in nature. I'm just saying that when something is run for as many years as it has here, to blow the dust off and look at it as you, I guess you've already agreed with that at least concept of doing it better, if nothing else, and for sure looking at it. So with that, welcome, Senator Skoy.
Oh, thank you, and I don't know, maybe we should hold questions till after the presentation, but Commissioner, you mentioned that the St. Mary's Lake, the land sale. I thought there was some issue with these school trust lands about selling them being in conflict with the effort to maximize revenues for the schools. Could you talk to me just a little bit about that?
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and if I misspeak, I'm going to turn to Director Kramka to correct me here. The Constitution describes how we must deal with school trust lands, and we can either exchange them in a fair exchange or we can sell them at public auction. So in this case, this was a public auction, and we got no bidders.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Director. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Larry Kramka. I'm the Director of Lands and Minerals for DNR, and I have with me today Dan Rourke as well, who's going to push the button and get it right, because I usually don't. Dan is an attorney on my staff and has helped me put this together, and also serves as our liaison to the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee. So he may also have some answers to some of the questions you may have as we go through this today. Let's go ahead and go right into the presentation. So we've talked a little bit about you know, this idea of where school trust lands are. The map that you see in front of you on the screen is, or on your in your file there, shows the distribution of the remaining school trust lands, the surface area that's associated with those trust lands. The colors are basically just the identifiers between the different ways in which those lands have come into the state's ownership, whether they were swamp school, the original school lands. It also includes the university lands, which were granted to the state for the land grant institution, the University of Minnesota. As you can see, that's predominantly in the northern part of the state, and encompasses primarily the forested area of the state. So as we peel apart what the school lands are, the first thing that I will draw your attention to is the original school lands concept really came from the English practice of setting aside lands for the purposes of schools. And when at colonial times, that practice kind of translated over to the original 13 colonies, and they adopted that as states were created across the western frontier. So you had in the Minnesota case, sections 16 and 36 were established as those school lands when the state was first identified as a territory, and then they were officially transferred at the time that we became a state. Along with that, there was the acknowledgement that because settlement had already been occurring, some of those lands may already have been settled on the section 16s and 36. There may be Indian reservations that had been established. These lands were also potentially underwater, and the federal government then included things called indemnity lands at that same time, which were then chosen after the state government was established. There was then a process that went through and basically identified those lands that were no longer available in that original school grant, and a subsequent grant from the federal government was given. Additionally, then later on, there was the swampland grant, which was basically lands that were underwater. The idea at that time was these were lands that could be potentially drained and developed, but the federal government wasn't in the business of doing that at the time, and that was really the state's role. And so those lands were also granted over to the state, and at that time brought into the permanent school fund as part of that that management. The internal improvement lands were later granted primarily during the railroad booms. These were lands that were meant to help pay off railroad bonds. There was also some idea there that those lands might be used actually with the railroads in mind and sold to those railroads to use. So the lands that we have that are within the school fund, basically the remaining lands that we have are 60% of those trust lands are really primarily wetlands. We have large peat land areas, for instance, that are comprised of quite a bit of the school lands that are on our current portfolio. We have another significant part of that is timberlands, but as you can see from the number, only a portion of those lands actually have commercial grade timber or are capable of producing commercial grade timber. The last point on the presentation here, the proximity to towns of 5,000 or more, is really just meant to show that these aren't lands that are outside of the metro area with large development potential. They reside quite a distance away from cities or towns that are going to be expanding, so you don't have the same development potential for these lands as you might if they were near an urban area.
Senator Kielash has a question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kronk, just for clarification, we're talking about just the school lands? Are we talking about the U of M's lands? I want to make sure that and are they mixed, or how is this, when we're talking about these lands, are we talking about?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kielash, those are, as I understand it, those are specifically the school lands portion, so not the university.
And the universities are
separate.
Separately. Thank you.
Yes, and the university lands, just to follow up on that, is a smaller subset of lands that came in. They came in after we already knew where the iron ore was, And so they were similarly picked to take advantage of some of the known resources that were out there and do have some higher value land associated with them because of that.
Thank you.
So the land characteristics, this map just shows you again the wetland distribution, and you'll notice that the wetland distribution lays right on top of a lot of those same school lands that are also within that timbered portion, and you have the description there of the commercial nature of those forested lands. And you know, really the colors here are about being able to show you that it is that small subset of lands that really have that commercial value for timber purposes. As I talked earlier, the distribution of land is in those northern counties. And if you look at this chart, it's pretty quick to see that, you know, the predominant area that we're talking about here is in three counties. And 90-some percent of those, you know, are limited within the 10-county area.
I'm sorry, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Director Kramka. It was interesting looking at this map and then this graph. What's the deal with northern Beltrami County? That's all state. A lot of that state land is bog up there and forest. And, I mean, very comparable to the land that's in Coochie County. Why is there no state forest land in that chunk of state land?
Director?
Mr. Chair, Senator, most of the northern Beltrami County, of course, is either in CONCON or other status. Those aren't school trust lands. That chart was talking about the school trust land distribution.
I get that, but I mean, when the school trust lands was set up prior to the CONCON issue coming out, I assume. So why were there, I mean, no school trust lands there when just across the county line in Cooch there is?
Mr. Kramka?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I think I understand your question, and if I don't, please correct me. Yeah. I believe that what you're seeing is two things. One of them is large Indian reservations that exist in those areas that would have limited the state's ownership to begin with, because the Red Lake reservation actually has never left the tribal ownership, for one thing. The other part of that is, you know, some of those school trust lands may have been sold early on with some of the drainage projects that had occurred up in that part of the state.
Okay. Interesting.
Without probably some further analysis,
this land right here,
you know, we could certainly look into that.
Mr. Kramka, maybe you could inform the committee with regards to tribal ownership here. If in fact there is a tribe that owns part of, do I understand it includes sections 16 and 36 of some of these areas? How is that land managed? And give us a little overview of that.
Mr. Chair, going back to what I had said earlier, if there had been other encumbrances on those lands, like a reservation or, as I said, things that were underwater, there was those indemnity lands that were then granted to make up for the lost land that would have been in Section 16 and 36 at that time. And those lands were then negotiated over, actually, I'm told, several decades to kind of get the proportion of lands then that the state had for permanent school fund purposes equalized. But those would have been back through the federal patents at that time, the lands that the federal federal government still held.
Thank you.
So the Department of Natural Resources has been given some additional help in managing school trust lands. As you're aware, we have an advisory committee that the legislature established that is in charge of basically looking at what we do to manage the permanent school fund lands give the commissioner advice on ways to implement our policies. They have some responsibilities to actually look at recommendations that specifically are to the enhancement of our management of these lands, costs that are associated with the management of these lands, and the ways in which we might look at those things differently. Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee is made up of, I believe it's 19 now, members. That membership has changed over time. The last, I believe two sessions ago, there were some additions to this. I'm not going to read you the list because I think you can do that, but it, as you can see, it is made up of a fairly diverse group of people. The members that are appointed from the education side of things are appointed by the Education Commissioner. The Department of Natural Resource Commissioner currently appoints those who have the mining, real estate, energy, finance, and natural resource conservation interests. And it has the committee chairs as outlined there as well.
So persons by appointed by the commissioner are non-voting members, then, according to your list here. Is that correct?
No, that is not correct. They're voting members. Except the only one that is not is the at-large.
Okay. Everybody understand that, members? Okay, thank you.
Very simplified version of how the revenue stream comes in from the school trust lands. But basically the timber surface rights like gravel, leases, any kinds of easements or things like that. And then the mineral rights, so leasing of iron, taconite, and copper, nickel, etc. All come in through the revenue side. The amount that is transferred to the State Board of Investment is, well, we'll get into the mechanics of that in a second, but basically those revenue streams, the gross, the net revenue gets transferred to the State Board of Investment. The State Board of Investment holds the corpus intact and invests that corpus, and then it is the interest and dividends that are distributed back out through to the public schools. This is just the policy statement that's in law. It gives us very clear direction on what the goal of the Permanent School Fund is, and that our job is to manage those lands for long-term sustained revenue while using good conservation and stewardship practices in which to do that. We believe that that stewardship function is part of the first part of this mission, which is long-term sustainable. We believe that good forest practices lead ultimately to good forests, which then can produce revenues over the long term. One thing that is often not talked about in the Permanent School Fund is actually the fact that the fund is also made up of that land base. It is the portfolio of land and the corpus that's in the account that actually is the fund. The long-term value of that land, you know, from statehood till now has appreciated over time, just as you can imagine. The obvious case is that the land itself is not liquid. You can't create cash from that unless you sell it, whereas you could take the revenue stream that's generated off of the interest of the investments much more quickly. But I think that it's really important that we understand that that land base is part of that long-term investment portfolio that the state holds for the Permanent School Fund. The value of the fund increases as the stock market increases. And so does the real estate value of the land. In addition to that, any increase in the value from the land appreciation, of course, when you do sell it or when you lease it, because the lease rates are based on the value of the land at the time, you gain that appreciated value at that time. We also generate considerable revenue from the mineral side of the equation. And I think the one thing that I would point out is many of the mineral resources that we're talking about today were certainly not known at the time that the Iron Range was booming. But we have those permanent school fund lands, those permanent school fund mineral rights that are now going to be able to get the benefit of knowing that we have copper, nickel, and other things that are out there that, that we can get those mineral revenues off of.
Mr. Senator, can you just give an example of what the surface contracts would be?
You could have, for instance, I'm sorry, excuse
Director,
me.
Director, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and committee, the surface contracts could be anything from a lease for use of that land by some commercial purpose. For instance, on the North Shore, there's a marina that's established on school trust lands, and there's a lease that, that is there. We have road easements, power lines that cross these lands. All of those kinds of things would be surface contracts.
Thank you.
So how does the revenue get generated, and how does it go into the equation here? Mineral revenues primarily are 80% of those revenues are directly sent to the corpus or to the State Board of Investment for investing. The minerals management account was set up as a temporary measure a number of years ago and then turned into a permanent measure for the department to manage the mineral resources for the state and to generate the long-term return to the school trust as well as other lands that we have mineral rights on. The formula for how the mineral management account works is 20% of any royalty that comes in is taken off and put to the mineral management account for the purposes of running the mineral leasing program and our exploration activities that that generate the new development and new business in minerals area. So 80%, simple equation, the 80% goes right into the account. 20% is taken off to do the management work of mineral leasing. And at the end of each fiscal year, there's an accounting and do we have a slide on that, Dan?
Yeah.
We'll have another slide and I'll show that in more detail. Net revenue from the forest suspense account. The net revenue from the forest suspense account goes directly to the corpus. Any land sales that we do are directly deposited into the corpus of the account. And water crossing licenses without any additional costs go directly to the account.
So what you're saying, you said 80% of it is going into the trust account net. So am I to understand then the cost of managing the land is included in that? Or is that after management is taken out?
Mr. Chair, I probably should have waited until I had the slide that's coming up, and it might be a little bit more clear. And if I can hold off to that, then hopefully that'll answer that question. The overall gross net revenue, this is just the graph over since 2002. You see on the left side the gross proceeds coming in from both timber and surface, minerals, and then the land sales based on the different colors there. And on the right side of each of those bar graphs then is the net. What you see prior to, I believe it's 2006, is a fairly stable number there assigned to the mineral revenue and gross is the net and gross is the same, and that's because at that time mineral management activities were actually funded through the general fund, and there was a shift after that to the mineral management account. So that's a relatively new phenomenon. This is just the details over the last couple of years. Again, what you can see is timber revenue has actually been pretty stable the last few years, which actually might be surprising to some because, you know, we've seen the downturn in the industry and in the development side, and yet we've been able to actually increase the value, you know, coming to the trust in the last 2 years. The mineral side, of course, on the other hand, has been going quite a bit heavier. But I also want to point out that the mineral revenues are also dependent on where the mines are mining at any given time. So not only are they mining school trust lands, they're also mining other lands, private, other state lands, et cetera. So even though you may see a $10 million change in the net here, it isn't necessarily that there has been just a change in the price. There also may be more ore being mined from school lands in that given year. So it's I just want to make sure that it's clear that you know, their mine plan really is what dictates where they're mining. And as they're going down, they have to move around to different various parcels of land. And so that can change from year to year, regardless of how the industry is performing.
Question I have, Mr. Kramp, is with the building industry obviously in an absolute downturn, downspin, how have you been able to continue the timber sales as high as you have?
Mr. Chair, I would have to defer on that, answering that question, and I'm not sure that I... Commissioner informs me it's pulp and paper.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think we did see a huge decline in value from essentially 2006, 2009 as the housing industry collapsed. Pulp and paper is a substantial part of our end product, and that's not been dependent on the housing industry like the sawlogs has been. So it's a diverse portfolio of users, diverse forest. You know, our aspen is not used for building homes. It's used for paper and pulp primarily. So we still have buyers of that.
Senator Scoy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think in answer to your question, there was an old-time logger up in my neck of the woods who spent his life buying timber on DNR sales to log. And he said if he ever had an estate sale, he wanted DNR to manage the auction.
Mr. Chair, one other thing, if I could, is the state provides about 25% of the raw material to the mills. And when the market crashed, a big component of the supply is private landowners, landowners who saw that their timber was worth $100 a cord, you know, in 2006, were unwilling to sell when it went 50 or 20 or 30. Well, the state sells by auction, so we were continuing to sell, and our prices weren't quite as volatile. So more of the industry shifted to the state supply and shifted away from both the private and the federal supply. I think the counties and the state were still the primary providers to the industry.
So then you would be no doubt selling it cheaper, obviously, then. You're kind of forced,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we sell at auction. Yeah. So we don't have a fixed price in mind. Whatever the market bears is what we will sell it at. And as we all know from an auction, somebody will pay some price for it eventually.
Sure. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, if I'd have looked at my notes, I also would have been able to say that, you know, part of that is back to that whole stewardship side that we talked about right at the beginning. Managing forest health over the long haul includes managing timber cuts. And so it is actually a good stewardship practice as well for us to continue to sell those timber sales to try to get the age of the forest the way that we want it for the future, as well as manage the health of those trees going forward. This is the breakdown of strictly the mineral receipts, and back to one of the questions that was asked earlier. Here's where you get to see the actual school, university, and tax forfeited part of the mineral equation. As you can see, the vast majority of the school or of the revenue that's generated in minerals activity right now is generated on school lands, and those school lands provide a pretty important building block for the iron industry in the state as compared to some of the other state lands that we hold. If you see at the bottom, the line in red near the bottom there is, again, just illustrating that that's the costs that are assigned and appropriated for management of minerals activities. And you can see that that has basically stayed the same across the timeline that's shown here. It's approximately $2.8 million a year that we are appropriated to manage mineral resources for the various state interests.
I don't know if you have the answer to the question, but how many FTEs do you use for managing the trust lands? You got any idea what that is and what that cost is?
It's at 23, 30.
I don't know if these
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I might jump in here because I have seen those numbers and I'm going from memory here. Because we have two separate operations here, we have minerals management, we have forest management, approximately 100 FTEs in the forest management are covered by trust fund dollars, and approximately 30 are in the Division of Lands and Minerals managing the minerals part of this. So in total, about 130 positions are paid for by trust fund revenues.
I guess, do you know, too, just information for the committee, how that's been, has that been staying pretty stable? Do you recall your records looking back at all? If you don't have the answer to these questions, maybe you should be prepared for the, you know, when the bill actually comes forward for those kinds of questions. So,
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the answer to that. I believe it's been pretty stable, but I'm not certain on it.
You may prepare yourself with that. So, thank you.
Thank you. We do have those numbers. I just don't have them in front of me, so we will get those.
I'm sorry, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Kramka, maybe when you're doing that research, you could, one of the questions I think that I would have when you come back with that would be, how do you determine that? Well, obviously, you're going out and you have a, you know, 40, 160 in the middle of thousands of acres, and in, so how do you determine how to calculate the FTEs? That would be helpful when you bring that back.
Good. Thank you.
Another thing that I might ask, too, that you supply the committee with would be the you have a state mineral receipt fund. We just went over that. Do you have one of those for the timber portion? Logging portion, maybe.
Yes, there
maybe
is.
Maybe it's here. I'm sorry. I might have missed it.
There is an account called the forest suspense account that, you know, would also be able to, we can provide a lot more detail on all
Thank
of those.
Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead.
So going forward, back to the question that you had asked me earlier, the minerals management account was set up to manage all of the work that the division does to expand the business side of minerals in the state, produce new markets, and manage the mineral leases and states' mineral rights going forward, and then to also basically generate that income on the backside. 20% of the income that comes into that account is derived from the receipts, the gross receipts that come in from all of the mineral lease activities. 80% then of that amount goes directly to the permanent school fund at the time that we get those, and those payments are made quarterly by the mineral interests. On top of that, the legislature actually appropriates the specific amount that we're authorized to spend out of the mineral management account. The mineral management account's capped at $3 million at the end of each fiscal year. The 20% is basically creating the cash flow for that account over the course of the year. And in years where we have lots of revenue coming in on the mineral side, you would expect that there would be a potential surplus. The surplus is then reconciled at the end of each fiscal year, as you can see on the right side of the chart there, And anything that's held at the end of the fiscal year above $3 million, so $3 million is our starting point for each fiscal year, is then refunded directly to the permanent school fund, SBI, side of things each year. There are also those down years where we don't have, you know, the robust revenue coming in. And so we have seen times when you may not get to that $3 million amount. And then there wouldn't be any additional refund back to the state school fund account at that time. As a percentage of cost, when you look at what that 20%, if you look at what the mineral management account is derived from, so it's that 20% of the royalties, and when you go back and then do that accounting to shift the amount that's above $3 million at the end of a fiscal year, we go back and look at the previous bienniums distribution of funds that came in from the mineral leases. So we get mineral revenues from school lands, we get mineral revenues from university trust lands, and we get mineral revenues from tax forfeited lands. The portion that gets attributed to the credit back is based on the previous biennium's percentage of those revenues that were attributed to the school fund. And these were the amounts that then were credited to the school fund based on that distribution, looking back in time. And the percentage of revenue cost on the right side of the chart is just the simple math. If you took the amount that was refunded times the cost that it was to, or the amount that came in, that's the percentage of cost. So it's not a true costing, because my costs remain 2.86 per fiscal year as you've appropriated. This is based on the actual distribution that comes in each year, so you have variability. University lands may have more revenue being produced in 1 year. School lands may be more another year. You get that variability then in this number. Forest management costs, the revenue from timber sales, leases, license, easements, all of the activities on the surface of the forest lands, grant and aid trail permits, those are all deposited into the forest suspense account. The forest suspense account is the place then where forestry activities are able to be extracted out as cost using a certification process that goes through the Department of Management and Budget to certify eligible costs against the receipts that are in the forest management account. Those costs are, as you can see at the bottom, protection activities, improvements, silvicultural practices, forest pest management, maintenance of forest roads, et cetera, then are extracted out of the forest suspense account prior to those receipts being deposited, the remainder of those receipts being deposited into the permanent school fund.
Mr. Kramka, then, to that chart, the forest management costs, I'm looking here, I don't see the similar chart that you have for the minerals management cost. Am I missing that, or is that something that would...
We don't have a similar chart, Mr. Chair.
We understand numbers. That's what I'm trying to say here. So I don't know if you have that. If you have that, we could certainly get that as well and do a comparison. It's nice to see what the minerals are doing as well as the timber revenues. So,
yep.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Kramka, perhaps you could talk about the importance of the need for the forest road management, because, I'll let you. You'll be able to say it better than I will.
Mr. Graham.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, the you know, access to timber is the only way that you can actually generate not only the revenue off of those lands, but also back to that forest health equation. We have to be able to get to those lands and those timber stands to do timber stand improvement activities such as thinning, pruning, any kind of disease management. But also it's very important on the fire side of the equation to be able to get in to put out forest fires and wildfires before they damage the assets that we're entrusted to maintain. So trust management costs versus the trust revenues. What you can see here is out of that 2.2 million acres of trust land managed by forestry, 1.49 million acres of that land is actually capable of producing commercial timber, back to that 66% number that we talked about earlier. Approximately 29,000 acres of that are reserved from harvest. About 18,000 acres are harvested in any given year. That's been a fairly stable number over time. About 1% of the total is harvested in any given year in that in the commercial forest area.
What does that equate to for cords? You know?
I don't know the cord number, and of course it is dependent on the site, you know, the specific stand qualities and the types of trees that are out there. So in any given year, that 1% could be more aspen or more pine or whatever, you know, happens to be at the time. You don't have that, do you? Go ahead, Dan.
Sir Chair, committee
members. I knew that he would come in handy.
Welcome to the committee. Kind of delayed welcome here. Please identify yourself. Thanks.
I'm Dan Rourke. I'm an attorney with the Lands and Minerals Division of the Minnesota DNR. And the cord numbers for sales, we have the approximate acre numbers. In fiscal 10, the cords was 322,000 cords, and that was on 17,700 acres. And in fiscal 11, 382,000 cords on 19,300 acres.
Thank you.
So as we've talked about the cost of certification, this just gives you a little bit more of the specifics about the kinds of activities that actually get broken down into those various cost categories. As you can see, our protection activities are, a lot of that work is in the fire management side of the equation. Forest management activities is everything from our timber sales to planning the future of those forests. Improvement activities can include things such as timber stand improvements, so the thinning, pruning, reforestation activities. Forest roads are self-explanatory. And then on the far right, the administrative costs of just running all of those contracts and the people that are out there doing the work.
Sure. Senator Skoy.
Thank you. Director, just looking at this graph, and it's striking to me that you must have about $10 or $8 million worth of activity that you just said is contingent on having a good forest road network, and that's $16,000?
Mr. Krenka.
excuse me. Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, I believe that this is the portion that's solely attributable to the school trust lands.
But Mr. Chair and Mr. Kramka, but all of these other numbers would also just be attributable to the school trust lands. The 1.16 million of fire protection would also just be the school trust portion, right?
Yes, but the road the road system is on other lands as well, and we use bonding as part of the equation for maintaining our road network as well. And those bonding costs then would not be. Fully accounted for in the cost certification side of things in any given year.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Krapka, if you're using state bonding dollars for forestry roads, how do you close those off then? Because a lot of these forest roads get closed off when you're not utilizing. There's been a pretty significant number of gates gone up, et cetera. How does that work?
Mr. Krapka.
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, forest road closures are for a number of different reasons, including site conditions. At the time, if we're in a wet situation, we may close those roads off due to safety and maintenance concerns. Predominantly, those are the reasons why you would close off roads. You may close roads off during times of a fire or something like that as well.
Okay, thank you.
The question I would have is the under the protection and the forest management, the numbers are $1.6 for fire protection and $4.33 million for forest management. Can you go over those two, just how exactly you come up with those numbers?
It would, Mr. Chair, it would probably be easier for us to provide you with the full certification report that really details out all of those activities in a much greater detail. That report for fiscal year 11 has just been completed, I believe, and we'd be happy to get that to the committee as well.
Okay, that's good. I'm just wondering, is there a place in the DNR website where some of this information, some of these questions I'm asking here that can be obtained? Are they
yes,
open to the
Mr.
public?
Chair, yeah. There is.
Assuming they are. Thank you. I'm sorry, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Kramka, where I'm struggling a little bit maybe is on the fire suppression side. It's my understanding that over the course of the last couple million years, forests have been burned by any number of measures, whether it was lightning or not, and trees grow back, and it's a product of nature. It'd be my understanding that fire suppression would be for the protection of private property and personal lives. Why would we... It's not. I don't. I really struggle in here. I don't believe that there's any private property or people that inhabit the trust lands. Is that correct,
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Krapka.
Senator Carlson, that would be correct. Fire suppression is also to protect assets, just like a warehouse that starts on fire when nobody's there. You put it out because you don't want the assets that are contained inside of it to go away. You want to protect those and keep those, and that's part of the fire management equation that we have as well. We're trying to protect the asset of those trees so that the long-term revenue could be there for the school fund.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But at the same time, some lands you burn on purpose. And so I guess... For me, and I don't know, and this isn't the DNR's part, so don't mm-hmm. take this the wrong way. Perhaps as a legislative body, we ought to be removing that and paying for that fire suppression somewhere else, because quite honestly, I guess I don't think that probably belongs there. That maybe would help you out too, if we could do that statutorily. I realize it would have to come from somewhere, but it just seems like that's a poor place to put that cost.
Senator Carlson, could I ask maybe a question? You're concerned about the cost, obviously, the yearly cost. I was as well. That was going to be my next question. What percentage of the total yearly expense here are we talking about is $1.16 million for fire suppression? Do we know that percentage at all?
Mr. Chair, well,
those are pretty tough numbers to throw together real quickly, I know.
Well, he's putting looking for the number. Let me just offer that with respect to when the department burns land, it's typically grasslands. We burn grasslands to manage them. We rarely burn forest lands. And if we do, it might be to regenerate something like jack pine, which is a fire-dependent species. And the intention is not to kill the trees, it's to get the seeds out of the cones and regenerate the species. So forest fire protection is absolutely critical for the state of Minnesota for a number of reasons. One is it's the asset, as Director Kramka mentioned, but we also know, as evidenced by the Pagami Creek fire this year, that a fire that's allowed to burn is extraordinarily unpredictable, and what is not threatening private property today might be tomorrow. So we do put out all fires on state land that are considered wildfires.
I'm sorry, Senator Kulesh.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kramka, one of the I think the things that is concerning to some folks is whether or not the DNR is getting more than their fair share of the state. State school trust fund money to manage and whatever. And the certified cost report, could you, does that mean that we've certified that the DNR's share of managing or whatever the state school trust fund dollars has been, you know, calibrated, certified that that's legitimate cost or whatever? Or could you just go in to explain that? I think there's question about whether or not we're funding DNR with school trust fund money, and talk about how that's the oversight on that.
Excuse me, Senator Skoy, you have a follow-up with
no,
that?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay,
wait
Senator,
till afterwards.
Excuse me, Director Kramka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kulesh, the certified costs are the process in which we go through and actually do that kind of full accounting of the management activities that are done on school forest lands in any given year, and certify that those activities listed and the amounts of work that was done under those different activities is attributable to the school fund or to the school lands that we manage. And the certification is basically a step in which you match those costs up and say, yes, these were the actual costs that the department is eligible to charge against those school lands because it was work that was done for school lands.
Just to clarify, yeah, and that means you're holding the DNR accountable for the numbers they're giving you for the charges and able to scrutinize their books in order to say this is in fact attributable to the land. So there is an oversight of the DNR by the division on school trust funds for those costs.
Mr. Director.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kulesh, there's actually a couple of steps in that process. Forestry originally puts that list together and in effect certifies that that's the right cost to be attributed to those. It's further then approved through our Office of Management and Budget Services, where our CFO signs off on, yes, those are indeed the costs. And then it takes another step and goes to the Management and Budget Office for a final check on those costs.
Just a follow-up. Yeah, and if there's a discrepancy or dispute over what over the funds between, how is that resolved?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kulesh, I don't think have those disputes because if you have that type of oversight, you get it right the first time.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of along that line, when I asked a question about the $16,000 for forest roads, it was the reason that number is small like that is because there's a small percentage of roads on these, you know, school trust lands. But that then means that the fire protection is 100 times what the road account is. The forest management is 400 times. The administration is over 100 times what the road account is on those very same lands. That's quite startling.
Director Kramka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I believe that the report for certified costs will give you a much better understanding of why those numbers look the way they do, including some additional information on how the forest road side of that equation works. I'm just not, I don't have all of that in my.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could address that. The
Commissioner.
There is in our bonding request every biennium a line item for forest roads. Most and we don't distinguish between forest roads going through school trust lands versus other state forest roads. So the majority of the capital costs associated with Forest Rose are paid for out of bonding. That $16,000 is, I can't tell you exactly what it is, but it's some ancillary dollar amount that would not be eligible for bonding expense.
I believe there's also a Forest Road account that comes from the gas proceeds, too, as well. Senator Scoy?
No, that answers my question.
Yep. Forrest. We're talking about Forrest today. We have Forrest with us. Welcome to the committee.
The aptly named director of
Forrest. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
We're able to do that in Minnesota.
For the record,
legislature.
Forrest Bowe, director of forestry, second day on the job.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, you're absolutely correct. There is unrefunded gas tax that comes to the division. As I recall, it's around $400,000 a year. Of course, some of that would be spent on the trust lands. In addition to that, as Commissioner Landwehr says, we utilize bonding dollars for the improved roads in our state forests, not for the skid roads or small haul roads, but for the improved roads that are open to the public.
I get it. Thank you.
Thank you for clarifying that. Please proceed. Sorry, Senator Scoy, did you get your question answered with regards to the costs of these particular areas here? I'm sorry, did he mention that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just looking at it in a scale and understanding that some of the money for the roads is coming out of the gas tax account and everything. It puts the scale a little bit more in line. I mean, $1.16 million for fire protection on how many acres, you know, somebody'd have to look at what the fire protection budget is for all the state and kind of ratio it out and make sure it makes sense. But, you know, that would be something for
And I think, too, the testimony, if I'm not mistaken, was about 120 FTEs. Is that what we're talking about again? Is that what it was?
About 130.
130? Okay. So, okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Senators, I should have just asked Forrest to come up rather than struggle through that, so I apologize. Distribution of the permanent school fund revenue is principal is perpetual and inviolate. That's handled by the State Board of Investment. They manage that investment for the return. Interest and dividends from those investments are distributed to the public schools throughout the state. In fiscal year 11, that was about $23 million. Corpus is currently about $785 million. Permanent school fund income used to be offset against the state's general fund. Deduction from the education aid was repealed in 2010, and it is now distributed to the schools as a separate and separately identifiable distribution into the formula. One of the things that you've certainly heard about has been the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness School Fund lands. The agency's been working on trying to get those lands that are locked up in the wilderness designation that came to us at statehood exchanged out and able to produce revenue once again for the state. In 2009, the DNR and the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee worked together with the Forest Service to develop a plan in order to try to get that compensation handled. At the time, there was a lot of discussion on whether we should be just paid cash completely for all of the lands that were in the Boundary Waters or whether there should be an exchange of lands. That effort led to the legislature in 2010, as you can see, passing Resolution 1, which actually said that we ought to pursue that as a one-third land and two-thirds as cash. The DNR and the Forest Service have been working on identifying that one-third acreage parcels that we could exchange out. over the last couple of years and have recently agreed on a portfolio of about 41,000 acres that we think we can choose from to get us up to about the 38,000 acres that that would make up that one-third portion of the land that's in the boundary waters. The reason why we have 41,000 acres is because we still have to get down into the real fine level detail of making sure that the lands that we choose have revenue generating capacity, are of the kind of quality and character that we want to have in our state school fund portfolio going forward, and that there aren't other things that might limit or reduce the ability for those lands to produce. We've done that at a high level screen. We think we have a good package to pick from and that we'll be able to get into the 38,000, you know, acres that we need. And if you need more information, please call Forrest Bow, the new forestry director.
I do. Thank you. I do actually have a question. Again, going back to the FTEs and going back to the page of examples of allowable costs of certification with the pictures on it. If you could, for the next meeting, prepare yourself with the numbers of FTEs for each individual area there, that would be of interest, I think, to the committee.
Well, and Mr. Chair, if they're going to do some information gathering on this part of the budgeting, you know, it might be nice to know just kind of what the total budget is in these areas and then the number of acres that are being managed in the total state forest and then a total for the state school trust lands and kind of a percentage on what that is and see if those numbers kind of line up and make some sense.
Right. I'm sorry, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could we also get a breakdown on the administration side, too, of, you know, how much of this $101.84 million is, you know, clerical payroll, and then what other is the equipment in the fleet? Thank you.
Any further questions, members? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to make sure we point out that Commissioner Landwehr has really stepped up to the plate, and we need to recognize the fact that he's only been on the job for a year, and yet he's taking the grief for 150 years, and I don't think that's fair, you know, first of all. I wanted to thank Commissioner Landwehr for the op order. I think that that will go a long ways, and I think that the steps are being done to make sure that we are getting the best value. And I think the other thing that members need to understand is with this much forestry, and maybe we'd want, is Mr. Brandt still in the room? Where Mr. Brandt could maybe even talk about, when you manage forest land, you have to have boots on the ground marking trees. It's a lot different than signing a lease and then just sitting back and taking royalties. Sure. On oil and gas, and there's a huge difference, and I maybe we can squeeze some more profits out of that for the schools, and I sense that Commissioner Landwehr is wanting to do that, so I think that we ought to make sure that we, in the spirit of giving Commissioner Landwehr some time to make sure that he gets that going. I just wanted to point that out, and
sure. We certainly appreciate Commissioner being here, and I don't know that he's taking 150 years worth of grief today. If that's all the grief
today,
he's going to get in this job, he's going
to
be.
We'd like to spread it out over a whole session.
We should really spread it out for a ways. We got a long ways to go yet,
Mr. Chairman.
But really, I really do appreciate you coming here. And the reason we're asking these tough questions is because it's on the table, and you certainly appreciate that. And we don't want anything hidden here. We're asking questions like we're being covert or something. That's not the intent of the committee at all. It's just that the committee is also some one-year people on the committee that need to understand things. And I've been here 6 years, and it's still not very clear to me. So that's why we're asking these questions. So,
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for the comments. I appreciate that. I do want to emphasize the point that forest management is much different than what is happening in Utah. Utah, as their organization, their department that manages the trust lands, has about 75 people, $10 million budget, and one forester who mostly manages contracts. They have two people that manage contracts for grasslands. All of their grasslands are leased out. Most of their staff are brokers, developers, attorneys, marketers. And so they have, you know, a huge staff that's dedicated to squeezing money out of this portfolio of land they have, most of which is, again, oil and gas revenue. So, again, it's a very different thing. We have to manage trees. Trees is very much a boots-on-the-ground activity. Mining less so, and as you can see, we're getting much more money out of the taconite and iron ore than we are out of timber.
Senator Kulesh. Yeah.
One of the questions I asked the folks from Utah, and I'll ask you, is there any limitations that the statutes or laws put on your ability to manage the lands efficiently to get the best bang for the buck out of these lands, whether it be limits your ability to develop them into commercial properties or any of that, that we could look at to try to allow you to get more, extract more dollars out of it for the public?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there truly are very few restrictions on us. The Constitution is one which says we must, manage for long-term revenue, but it also says we can only sell at a public auction. We can only exchange with other land in other cases. There, the statutory language that is provided to us, it says we must manage for the long-term consistent with natural resource, sound natural resource policies. Those are really about the only things. We have had, I will offer some legislative interest in some activities that we've tried in the past. We used to lease shoreland for cabin owners, and once upon a time we proposed to go to a bidding process on those lease lots, and the legislature concluded that that was not a good idea because people had already built cabins on there, and they would have to bid against somebody else. And so there have been instances where the legislature has helped guide us in the right direction on some of these activities. But by and large, I don't believe that we are limited in what we can do. I would offer that perhaps for development activities, we may not be the best entity to do development, but we are not prohibited from selling, per the example I gave earlier.
So, Commissioner, to that point, then, you certainly would be open to the legislature obviously coming up with not necessarily a remedy, I don't think that's the word, but with an idea that if the school trust lands could be managed better. Again, I'm not picking on him. I'm not saying they're not being managed better. You'd be certainly open to that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we should always be open to managing the trust lands better for the purposes for which they are established.
Certainly. Because I think, Commissioner, the Utah example that apparently has become apparently a pretty good model is a 501(c). Those aren't state employees. Is that correct?
That is correct. They are at-will employees. My understanding is they are probably compensated about twice the level of state employees. So there might be a substantial amount of interest in those. I did ask the director about that, and their mid-level people are in the high five figures, 70 or 90,000.
Commissioner's
approaches
wage?
That
commissioner's
of a senator.
Wage, we're talking about a commissioner's wage. Well, thank you. Any other questions? Certainly, you folks know that there's going to be a lot of questions down the line with if this moves forward with the bill that's in the hopper, and we'd certainly appreciate having those other questions answered. So thank you so much for the presentation. Thanks. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much.
6 years. 6 years. That's terrible.
16 for me.
I can't figure that out at all. I'm sorry. We're adjourned. We start out with a bang.